The killer had told the men at the service station that he had not yet touched Ariel in that way, and China believed him. Because once he had taken her innocence, he would need to smash her beauty, and when that was done, he would kill her. The fact that she was alive argued that she was still untouched. Yet day after day, month after dreadful month, she had lived in exhausting suspense, waiting for the hateful son of a bitch to decide that she was ripe. Waiting for his brutal assault, his sour breath on her face, his hot and insistent hands, the terrible, irresistible weight of him, every indignity and humiliation. In her single room, there had been nowhere to hide. She could not escape to the rooftop, to the beach, to the attic, to the crawl space, to the upper limbs of the tree in the backyard.
Ariel!
The refuge to which she had escaped might be in the pages of the book that she now held. She functioned in this world, grooming and feeding and bathing and dressing herself, but she lived in some other dimension. China's heart rolled in a sea of sorrow in a storm of rage, and through the port in the upholstered door she said,
"I'm here, Ariel. I'm here. You aren't alone anymore."
Ariel's gaze didn't shift out of dreams, and she was as still as any of the dolls.
"I am your guardian, Ariel. I'll keep you safe."
As the girl followed a long and winding road farther into her private elsewhere, her hands relaxed, and the book slipped out of them. It slid off the edge of the chair and thumped to the floor, and all except a whisper of the sound was absorbed by the special walls and ceiling. She was not aware of having dropped the volume, and she sat unmoving.
"I'm your guardian," China repeated, and wondered vaguely at her choice of words.
She was more afraid for Ariel than for herself, and her heart was racing faster than ever before.
"Your guardian."
Hot tears blurred China's vision, disabling tears, an indulgence she could not afford. She blinked furiously until her eyes were dry and her vision was clear. She turned from the locked inner door and angrily pushed open the outer one. Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. As she stepped out of the heavy sound baffling of the vestibule and into the first room in the basement, the rattling pipe seemed louder than she remembered. Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Perhaps a minute had passed since she'd slid aside the padded panel on the viewport. The son of a bitch bastard freak was still in his shower, naked and defenseless, and now that China knew where Ariel was, she didn't have to worry that the cops would need him to lead them to the girl. The gun felt good in her hand. It felt wonderful in her hand. If she could have freed Ariel and gotten her out of there, she would have done that rather than take the violent option. But she didn't possess a key, and that inner door was not going to be easy to break down. Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. She had only one choice. She went to the cellar stairs, blue steel gleaming in her hand. Even if he finished showering and shut off the water before China was able to reach him, he'd still be naked and defenseless, toweling off, so she would go in there, into the bathroom, and open fire on him point blank, shoot him down, empty the revolver into him, the first shot right through his fucking heart, then put at least one round in his face to be sure that he was really done for. Take no chances. No chances at all. Use every round. Squeeze the trigger until the hammer click-click-clicked on the expended cartridges in a totally empty cylinder. She could do it. Kill the crazy freak. Kill him over and over again. Kill him until he stayed killed. She could do it. Would do it. She climbed the steep stairs, treading on wet footprints that she'd left in her descent. China Shepherd no longer hiding, up and out of that hole, untouched, alive, coming out of Narnia forever. Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Thinking ahead as she moved, China wondered if she should shoot him through the shower curtain, if it was in fact a curtain instead of a glass door, because if she didn't shoot him through it, then she would have to hold the revolver in just one hand while she yanked the curtain or the door aside. That would be risky, because a strange and dismaying weakness was creeping into her fingers and into her wrists. Her arms were shaking so badly that already she had to grip the weapon with both hands to prevent herself from dropping it. Her heart rattling like the copper pipe, scared about the coming confrontation even if the crazy geek was naked and defenseless, China reached the upper landing and entered the laundry room.
She couldn't shoot him through the curtain because she wouldn't know whether she'd hit him or not. She'd be shooting blind, unable to aim for his chest or head. Past the dryer and the washer, through the fragrance of laundry detergent, she reached the open door to the kitchen. Crossing the threshold, she belatedly registered the important thing that she had seen on the landing at the head of the cellar stairs. Wet shoe prints larger than her own, among her prints, overlapping her prints, where he had stood only a short while ago. She was already rushing into the kitchen with too much momentum to halt, and the killer came at her from the right, past the dinette set. He was big, strong, a juggernaut, neither naked nor defenseless, the shower having been a ruse all along. He was fast, but she was marginally faster. He tried to drive her backward and slam her against the cabinets, but she slid out of the way, raising the revolver with the muzzle 3 feet from his face, and she pulled the trigger, and the hammer made a dry, stick-breaking sound as it fell on an empty chamber. She backed hard into the side of the refrigerator, dislodging the kittens and Lily's calendar, which clattered to the floor at her feet. The killer was still rushing at her. She squeezed the trigger and the revolver clicked again, which made no sense, shit, because the clerk in the service station never had a chance to fire it before he had been blown away by the shotgun. No cartridges should be missing. This was the first time that she had seen the killer's face. Always before, she'd glimpsed just the back of his head, the top of his skull, the side of his face, but from a distance. He was not what she had expected, not moon-faced and pale-lipped and heavy-jawed. He was handsome, with blue eyes that were a beautiful contrast with his dark hair, nothing crazy in his clear eyes, broad, clean features, and a nice smile. Smiling, he continued to come straight at her as she squeezed the trigger a third time, and the hammer fell yet again on an empty chamber. Smiling, he tore the revolver out of her hand with such force that she thought her finger broke before it slipped through the trigger guard, and she squealed in pain. The killer backed away from her, holding the weapon, his eyes sparkling with excitement. What a kick that was. China huddled against the side of the refrigerator, tramping on kitten faces.
I knew it was the same gun, he said. But what if I'd been wrong? I'd have one big hole in my face right now, wouldn't I, little lady?
Weak and dizzy with terror, she looked around desperately for anything that could be used as a weapon, but there was nothing close at hand.
One big hole in my face, he repeated, as if he found that prospect amusing.
One of the cabinets might contain knives, but she had no way of knowing which drawer to check.
Intense, he said,
smiling at the revolver in his hand. A pistol lay on the counter across the kitchen beside the sink, well out of her reach. China couldn't believe this. He had brought a gun of his own, but he hadn't used it, had set it aside, and had gone for her bare-handed instead.
You're an attractive woman.
She looked away from the pistol, hoping he hadn't noticed that she'd seen it, but she was fooling herself, and she knew it because he saw everything, everything. He pointed the revolver at her.
You were back there in the service station last night.
She was gasping for breath, but she didn't seem to be drawing any air. She was breathing too fast and too shallowly, in danger of hyperventilating, and she was furious with herself, furious because he was so calm. He said,
I know you were there. Somehow, somewhere, and I know you found this chief special after I left, but for the life of me, I can't figure out why you're here.
Maybe she would be able to get to the pistol before he could stop her. It was 1,000,000 to 1 chance, 2,000,000, 3, hell, face it, impossible. From 5 feet away, aiming the revolver at the bridge of her nose, his voice bubbly with exhilaration, the killer said,
But even though it was the Asian's piece, I was walking into the mouth of the dragon here. I was lucky just now. Are you?
Although reaching the pistol was probably impossible, she didn't have any alternative, nothing to lose. With a note of impatience, he said,
Honey, listen to me, please. I'm talking to you. Do you feel lucky right now? As lucky as I've been.
Trying not to stare at the pistol, reluctant to look into his two normal eyes, she gazed down the bore of the revolver and managed to say, No. And she half believed that she heard that single word echoing back to her out of the barrel. No.
Let's see if you are.
No.
Oh, be adventurous, sweetheart. Let's see if you are lucky,
he said, and he pulled the trigger. Although the weapon had failed to fire 3 times, she expected it to explode in her face, because that seemed to be the way luck was running for her, and she flinched.
Click. You are lucky. Even more so than I am.
China didn't know what he was talking about. She couldn't focus her thoughts on anything but the pistol by the sink, this last miraculous chance.
When Fuji started to pull this piece on me, the killer said, didn't you hear what I promised him?
All this talking and the bastard's calm demeanor unnerved China even further. She expected him to shoot her, cut her, beat her, and probably rape her, torture answers from her before or after, but she didn't expect to have to chat with him for God's sake, as if what they had been through was only a pleasant little road trip, a shared vacation that had taken a couple of interesting twists. Still pointing the revolver at her, he said,
what I told Fuji was, don't, or I'll shove the bullets up your ass. I always keep my promises. Don't you?
His patter finally captured her undivided attention.
In such poor light, and with all that blood everywhere, not wanting to look squeamish, you probably didn't see that Fuji's pants were pulled down.
He was right. After a glance showed her that the clerks were both dead, she had averted her eyes and stepped around their bodies.
He said, I managed to insert 4 rounds in him.
Now she closed her eyes, opened them at once. She didn't want to see him, looming and handsome with his nice smile, dry bloodstains on his clothes and nothing disturbing in his eyes, but she didn't dare look away.
China Shepherd, untouched and alive. I put 4 bullets in, he said, but then they started popping back out, a little post-mortem gas release. It was ridiculous, quite funny, really, but I was pressed for time, as you might understand, and finally it was just too much trouble to do the 5th.
Maybe this was best. Maybe 1 more round of Russian roulette, and then peace at long last. No more trying to understand why there was so much cruelty in the world when kindness was the easier choice. He said,
this is a 5-shot weapon.
The empty socket of the muzzle stared blindly at her, and she wondered if she would see the flash and hear the roar, or whether the blackness in the barrel would become her own blackness without any awareness of the exchange. Then the killer turned the revolver away from her and pulled the trigger. The blast rattled windows, and the slug tore through a cabinet door along the nearest wall, spraying splinters of pine and shattering dishes inside. Bits of wood were still flying when China grabbed a drawer and yanked it out of the cabinet. It was so heavy that it almost pulled out of her hand, but she was suddenly strong with desperation, and she slung it upward at the killer's head, the contents spilling from it as it arced high toward his brow. Spoons, forks, butter knives dueling in the air, flashing with cold fluorescent reflections, ringing down on him and across the tile floor, startled him backward into the dinette table. Even as the killer stumbled away in surprise, China was moving toward the sink. An instant after she heard the empty drawer crash against something, she put her hand on the grip of the pistol. She saw a red dot on the steel frame, which was probably exposed when the safety was off, as on other pistols with which she was familiar, and she didn't have to worry about empty chambers as with the revolver, because if there was even 1 bullet in the magazine, just 1, it would be in the breech, please, and at this close range, 1 round might be all that she needed. But her trigger finger was already stiffening and swelling, and when she tried to hook it through the guard, the flare of pain rocked her. She bobbled on a black tide of nausea, swayed, fumbling at the trigger guard with her middle finger. Skating across the littered floor with an ice-brittle clatter-clink of scattering tableware, the killer reached China before she could bring the gun up and turn. He slammed his arm down on hers and trapped her hand against the countertop. Reflexively, her finger pulled the trigger. A bullet smashed the backsplash. Chips of yellow ceramic tile sprayed in her face, and she might have been blinded if she hadn't squeezed her eyes shut in time. He slammed the heel of his hand against the side of her head, sending a spray of darkness across the backs of her eyes, like shards of exploding black glass, and then he clubbed his fist against the nape of her neck. With no memory of having fallen, China was lying on the kitchen floor with a bug's eye view across the vinyl tile, gazing through a cataclysmic tumble of eating utensils. Interesting. Spoons were the size of shovels, forks as big as pitchforks, knives were lances. The killer's boots, black boots, moving around. For a moment she became confused, thinking that she was back in the Templeton house in the Napa Valley, hiding under the bed in the guest room. But there hadn't been flatware scattered across that bedroom floor, and when she focused on the stainless steel utensils again, her thoughts cleared.
"Now I'm going to have to wash all these," the killer said, "before I put them away."
He was circling through the kitchen, picking up the flatware and being methodical about it, keeping spoons with spoons, knives with knives. China was surprised that she could move her arm, which was as heavy as a great tree limb, a petrified tree once wood, but now stone. Nevertheless, she managed to point at the killer and even curl her throbbing trigger finger, swallowing her pain and the bitter taste that came with it. The gun didn't fire. She squeezed the trigger again, and still there was no boom, and then she realized that her hand was empty. She wasn't holding the pistol. Strange. One of the knives was near her hand. It was a table knife with a finely serrated edge, suitable for spreading butter or for slicing well-cooked chicken or for cutting green beans into bite-sized pieces, but not ideal for stabbing someone to death. A knife was a knife, however, better than no weapon at all, and she quietly closed her hand around it. Now all she had to do was find the strength to get off the floor. Curiously, she couldn't even lift her head. She had never before felt so tired. She had been hit hard on the back of the neck. She wondered about spinal injury. She refused to weep. She had the knife. The killer came to her, stooped, and extracted the knife from her hand. She was amazed at how easily it slipped from her fingers, even though she clutched it ferociously, as if it hadn't been a knife at all, but a sliver of melting ice.
"Bad girl," he said, and wrapped the flat of the blade against the top of her skull.
He continued with the cleanup. While trying not to think about spinal injuries, China managed to get her hand around a fork. He returned and took that away from her, too.
"No," he said as though he was training a recalcitrant puppy. "No."
"Bastard," she said, dismayed to hear a slur in her voice.
"Sticks and stones." "Fucking bastard." "Oh, very pretty," he said scornfully. "Shithead. I should wash your mouth out with soap." "Asshole. Your mother never taught you words like that." "You don't know my mother," she said thickly.
He hit her again, a hard chop to the side of the neck this time. Then China lay in darkness, listening worriedly to her mother's distant gay laughter and strange men's voices, shattering glass, cursing thunder and wind, palm trees thrashing in the night over Key West. The quality of the laughter changed, mocking now, crashes that weren't thunder, and the skittery palmetto beetle over her bare legs and across her back. Other times, other places, in the vapory realm of dreams, the iron fist of memory.
Shortly after 9 o'clock in the morning, after dealing with the woman and washing the flatware, Mr. Vess sets loose the dogs. At the back door, at the front door, and in his bedroom, there are call buttons that, when pushed, sound a soft buzzer in the kennel behind the barn. When the Dobermans have been sent there with the word crib, as they were sent earlier, the buzzer is a command that at once returns them to active patrol. He uses the call button by the kitchen door and then steps to the large window by the dinette to watch the backyard. The sky is low and gray, still shrouding the Siskiyou Mountains, but rain is no longer falling. The drooping boughs of the evergreens drip steadily. The bark on the deciduous trees is a sodden black, their limbs, some with the first fragile green buds of spring, others still barren, are so coaly that they appear to have been stripped by fire. Some people might think that the scene is passive now, with the thunder spent and the lightning extinguished, but Mr. Vess knows that a storm is as powerful in its aftermath as in its raging. He is in harmony with this new kind of power, the quiescent power of growth that water bestows on the land. From the back of the barn come the Dobermans. They pad side by side for a distance, but then split up and proceed each in his own direction. They are not on attack status at this time. They will chase down and detain any intruder, but they will not kill him. To prime them for blood, Mr. Vess must speak the name Nietzsche.
One of the dogs, Liederkranz, comes onto the back porch where he stares at the window, adoring his master. His tail wags once and then once again, but he is on duty, and this brief and measured display of affection is all that he will allow himself. Liederkranz returns to the backyard. He stands tall, vigilant. He gazes first to the south, then west, and then east. He lowers his head, smells the wet grass, and at last he moves off across the lawn, sniffing industriously. His ears flatten against his skull as he concentrates on a scent, tracking something that he imagines might be a threat to his master. On a few occasions, as a reward to the Dobermans and to keep them sharp, Mr. Vess has turned loose a captive and has allowed the dogs to stalk her, foregoing the pleasure of the kill himself. It is an entertaining spectacle. Secure behind the screen of his four-legged Praetorian guard, Mr. Vess goes upstairs to the bathroom and adjusts the water in the shower until it is luxuriously hot. He lowers the volume of the radio but leaves it tuned to the swing music program. As he strips off his soiled clothing, clouds of steam pour over the top of the shower curtain. This humidity enhances the fragrance of the dark stains in his garments. Naked, he stands for a couple of minutes with his face buried in the blue jeans, the t-shirt, the denim jacket, breathing deeply at first but then delicately sniffing one exquisite nuance of odor after another, wishing that his sense of smell were 20,000 times more intense than it is, like that of a Doberman. Nevertheless, these aromas transport him into the night just past. He hears once more the soft popping of the sound suppressor on the pistol, the muffled cries of terror, and the thin pleas for mercy in the night calm of the Templeton house. He smells Mrs. Templeton's lilac-scented body lotion, which she'd applied to her skin before retiring, the fragrance of the sachet in the daughter's underwear drawer. He tastes, in memory, the spider. Regretfully, he puts the clothes aside for laundering, because by this evening he must pass for the ordinary man that he is not, and this reverse lycanthropy requires time if the transformation is to be convincing. Therefore, as Benny Goodman plays 1 o'clock jump, Mr. Vess plunges into the stinging hot water, being especially vigorous with the washcloth and lavish with a bar of Irish Spring, scrubbing away the too pungent scents of sex and death which might alarm the sheep. They must never suspect the shepherd of having a snaggle-toothed snout and bushy tail inside his herdsman's disguise. Taking his time, bopping to song after song, he shampoos his thick hair twice and then treats it with a penetrating conditioner. He uses a small brush to scrub under his fingernails. He is a perfectly proportioned man, lean but muscular. As always, he takes great pleasure in soaping himself, enjoying the sculpted contours of his body under his slippery hands. He feels like the music sounds, like the soap smells, like the taste of sweetened whipping cream. Life is. Vess lives. China came out of Key West darkness and tropical thunder into a fluorescent glare that stung her bleary eyes. At first she mistook the fear that drove her pounding heart for the fear of Jim Woltz, her mother's friend. She thought that her face was pressed to the floor under the bed in his seaside cottage, but then she remembered the killer and the captive girl. She was sitting forward in a chair, slumped over the round table in the dining area off the knotty pine kitchen. Her head was turned to her right, and she was looking through a window at the back porch, the backyard. The killer had removed a seat cushion from one of the other chairs and had placed it under her head so her face wouldn't press uncomfortably against the wood. She shuddered at his thoughtfulness. As she tried to lift her head, pain shot up the back of her neck and throbbed in the right side of her face. She almost blacked out and decided not to be in a rush about getting up. When she shifted in the chair, the clink of chains indicated that getting up might not be a choice either now or later. Her hands were in her lap, and when she tried to lift one, she lifted both, for her wrists were cuffed. She tried to pull her feet apart and discovered that her ankles were shackled. Judging by the noisy rattling and clinking that her small movements generated, there were other encumbrances as well. Outside, something as black as soot bounded across the green lawn, scampered up the steps, and crossed the porch. It came to the window, jumped up, put its paws on the window stool, and peered in at her. A Doberman pincher. Against her breasts, Ariel holds an open book as if it is a shield, hands splayed across the binding. She is in the enormous armchair, legs drawn up beneath her, the only perfect doll of all those in the room. Mr. Vess sits on a footstool before her. He cleans up well, showered, shampooed, shaved, and combed. He is presentable in any company, and any mother, seeing him on the arm of her daughter, would think that he was a prize. He is wearing loafers without socks, beige cotton dockers, a braided leather belt, and a pale green chambray shirt. In her schoolgirl uniform, Ariel looks good, too. Vess is pleased to see that she has regularly groomed herself in his absence, as she was instructed. It is not easy for her, taking only sponge baths and shampooing her glorious hair in the sink. He had constructed this room for others who came before her, none of whom was in residence longer than 2 months. Until he'd met his Ariel and learned what an engagingly independent spirit she was, he'd never imagined that he would insist on anyone staying this long. Consequently, a shower had seemed unnecessary. He had first seen the girl in a newspaper photograph. Though only a 10th grader, she had been something of a prodigy and had led her Sacramento high school team to victory in a statewide California academic decathlon. She had looked so tender. The newspaper had trembled in his hands when he had seen her, and he had known at once that he must drive to Sacramento and meet her. He'd shot the father. The mother had owned an enormous collection of dolls and had made dolls of her own as a hobby. Vess had beaten her to death with a ventriloquist dummy that had a large carved maple head as effective as a baseball bat. "You're more beautiful than ever," he tells Ariel, and his voice is muffled by the soundproofing, as if he is speaking from inside a coffin, buried alive. She does not reply or even acknowledge his presence. She is in her silent mode, as she has been without interruption for more than 6 months. "I missed you." These days she never looks at him but stares at a point above his head and off to one side. If he were to stand up from the footstool and move into her line of sight, she would still be looking over his head and to one side, though he would never quite be able to see her eyes shift in avoidance. "I brought a few things to show you." From a shoebox on the floor beside the footstool, he extracts 2 Polaroid photographs. She will not accept them or turn her eyes to them, but Vess knows that she will examine these mementos after he leaves. She is not as lost to this world as she pretends to be. They are engaged in a complicated game with high stakes, and she is a good player. "The first is a picture of a lady named Sarah Templeton, the way she looked before I had her. She was in her 40s, but very attractive. A lovely woman." The armchair is so deep that the seat cushion provides a ledge in front of Ariel on which Vess can place the photograph. "Lovely," he repeats. Ariel doesn't blink. She is capable of staring fixedly without blinking for surprisingly long periods. Now and then Mr. Vess worries that she will damage her striking blue eyes. Corneas require frequent lubrication. Of course, if she goes too long without blinking and her eyes become dangerously dry, the irritation will cause tears to spring up involuntarily. "This is a second photograph of Sarah, after I was finished with her," Mr. Vess says, and he also places this picture on the chair. "As you can see, if you choose to look, the word lovely doesn't apply anymore. Beauty never lasts. Things change." From the shoebox, he takes 2 more photographs. "This is Sarah's daughter, Laura, before and after. You can see she was beautiful, like a butterfly. But there's a worm in every butterfly, you know." He places these snapshots on the chair and reaches into the box again. "This was Laura's father. Oh, and here's her brother and the brother's wife. They were incidental." Finally, he brings out the 3 Polaroids of the young Asian gentleman and the Slim Jim with the bite missing. "His name is Fuji, like the mountain in Japan." Vess puts 2 of the 3 photos on the chair. "I'll keep one for myself, to eat, and then I'll be Fuji, with the power of the east and the power of the mountain, and when the time comes for me to do you, you'll feel both the boy and the mountain in me, and so many other people all their power. It'll be very exciting for you, Ariel, so exciting that when it's over, you won't even care that you're dead." This is a long speech for Mr. Vess. He is for the most part not a garrulous man. The girl's beauty, however, moves him now and then to speeches. He holds up the Slim Jim. The missing bite was taken by Fuji just before I killed him. His saliva will have dried on the meat. You can taste a little of his quiet power, his inscrutable nature. He puts the wrapped sausage on the chair. I'll be back after midnight, Mr. Vess promises. We'll go out to the motorhome so you can see Laura, the real Laura, not just the picture of her. I brought her back so you could see what becomes of all pretty things. And there's a young man, too, a hitchhiker that I picked up along the way. I showed him a photograph of you, and I just didn't like the way he looked at it. He wasn't respectful. He leered. I didn't like something he said about you, so I sewed his mouth shut, and I sewed his eyes shut because of the way he looked at your picture. You'll be excited to see what I did to him. You can touch him and Laura. Vess watches her closely for any tick, shudder, flinch, or subtle change in the eyes that will indicate that she hears him. He knows that she hears, but she is clever at maintaining a solemn face and a pretense of catatonic detachment. If he can force one faint flinch from her, one tick, then he will soon shatter her completely and have her howling like a goggle-eyed patient in the deepest wards of Bedlam. That collapse into ranting insanity is always fascinating to watch. But she is tough, this girl, with surprising inner resources. Good. The challenge thrills him. And from the motorhome we'll go out to the meadow with the dogs, Ariel, and you can watch while I bury Laura and the hitchhiker. Maybe the sky will clear by that time, and maybe there'll be stars or even moonlight. Ariel huddles on the chair with her book, eyes distant, lips slightly parted, a deeply still girl. Hey, you know, I bought another doll for you, an interesting little shop in Napa, California, a place that sells the work of local craftsmen. It's a clever rag doll. You'll like it. I'll give it to you later. Mr. Vess gets up from the footstool and takes a casual inventory of the contents of the refrigerator and the cabinet that serves as the girl's pantry. She has enough supplies to carry her 3 more days, and he will restock her shelves tomorrow. You're not eating quite as much as you should, he admonishes. That's ungrateful of you. I've given you a refrigerator, a microwave, hot and cold running water. You've got everything you need to take care of yourself. You should eat. The dolls are no less responsive than the girl. You've lost 2 or 3 pounds. It hasn't affected your looks yet, but you can't lose any more. She gazes into thin air, as if waiting for her voice box string to be pulled before she recites recorded messages. Don't think you can starve yourself until you're haggard and unattractive. You can't escape me that way, Ariel. I'll strap you down and force-feed you if I have to. I'll make you swallow a rubber tube and pump baby food into your stomach. In fact, I'd enjoy it. Do you like pureed peas? Carrots? Applesauce? I guess it doesn't matter since you won't taste them unless you regurgitate. He gazes at her silken hair, which is red-blonde in the filtered light. This sight translates through all 5 of Vess's extraordinary senses, and he is bathed in the sensory splendor of her hair, in all of the sounds and smells and textures that the look of it conveys to him. One stimulus has so many associations for him that he could lose himself for hours in the contemplation of a single hair or one drop of rain if he chose, because that item would become an entire world of sensation to him. He moves to the armchair and stands over the girl. She doesn't acknowledge him, and although he has entered her line of sight, her gaze has somehow shifted above and to one side of him without his being aware of the movement when it happened. She is magically evasive. Maybe I could get a word or two out of you if I set you on fire. What do you think? A little lighter fluid on that golden hair. And whoosh. She does not blink. Or I'll give you to the dogs. See if that unties your tongue. No flinch, no tick, no shudder. What a girl. Mr. Vess stoops, lowering his face toward Ariel's, until they are nose to nose. Her eyes are now directly aligned with his, yet she is still not looking at him. She seems to peer through him as if he is not a man of flesh and blood, but a haunting spirit that she can't quite detect. This isn't merely the old trick of letting her eyes swim out of focus. It's a ruse infinitely more clever than that, which he can't understand at all. Nose to nose with her, Vess whispers,
We'll go to the meadow after midnight. I'll bury Laura and the hitchhiker. Maybe I'll put you into the ground with them and cover you up, 3 in 1 grave, them dead and you alive. Would you speak then, Ariel? Would you say please?
No answer. He waits. Her breathing is low and even. He is so close to her that her exhalations are warm and steady against his lips, like promises of kisses to come. She must feel his breath, too. She may be frightened of him and even repulsed by him, but she also finds him alluring. He has no doubt about this. Everyone is fascinated by bad boys. He says, maybe they'll be stars. Such a blueness in her eyes, such sparkling depths. Or even moonlight, he whispers.
The steel cuffs on China's ankles were linked by a sturdy chain. A second and far longer chain, connected by a carabiner to the first, wound around the thick legs of the chair and around the stretcher bars between the legs, returned between her feet, encircled the big barrel that supported the round table, and connected again to the carabiner. The chains didn't contain enough play to allow her to stand. Even if she'd been able to stand, she would have had to carry the chair on her back, and the restricting shape and the weight of it would have forced her to bend forward like a hunchback troll, and once again she could not have moved from the table to which she was tethered. Her hands were cuffed in front of her. A chain was hooked into the shackle that encircled her right wrist. From there it led around her, wound between the back rails of the chair behind the tie-on pad, then to the shackle on her left wrist. This chain contained enough slack to allow her to rest her arms on the table if she wished. She sat with her hands folded, leaning forward, staring at the red and swollen index finger on her right hand, waiting. Her finger throbbed and she had a headache, but her neck pain had subsided. She knew that it would return worse than ever in another 24 hours, like the delayed agony of severe whiplash. Of course, if she was still alive in another 24 hours, neck pain would be the least of her worries. The Doberman was no longer at the window. She had seen two at once on the lawn, padding back and forth, sniffing the grass in the air, pausing occasionally to prick their ears and listen intently, then padding away again, obviously on guard duty. During the previous night, China had used rage to overcome her terror before it had incapacitated her, but now she discovered that humiliation was even more effective at quelling fear. Having been unable to protect herself, having wound up in bondage, that was not the source of her humiliation. What mortified worse was her failure to fulfill her promise to the girl in the cellar. "I am your guardian. I'll keep you safe." She kept returning in memory to the upholstered vestibule and the viewport on the inner door. The girl among the dolls had given no indication that she had heard the promise. But China was sick with the certainty that she had raised false hopes, that the girl would feel betrayed and more abandoned than ever, and that she would withdraw even further into her private elsewhere. "I am your guardian." In retrospect, China found her arrogance not merely astonishing, but perverse, delusional. In 26 years of living, she'd never saved anyone in any sense whatsoever. She was no heroine, no mystery novel series character with just a colorful dash of angst and a soupçon of endearing character flaws and otherwise the competence of Sherlock Holmes and James Bond combined. Keeping herself alive, mentally stable, and emotionally intact had been enough of a struggle for her. She was still a lost girl herself, fumbling blindly through the years for some insight or resolution that probably wasn't even out there to be found, yet she'd stood at that viewport and promised deliverance. "I am your guardian." She opened her folded hands. She flattened her hands on the table and slid them across the wood as if smoothing away wrinkles in a tablecloth, and as she moved, her chains rattled. She wasn't a fighter, after all. No one's paladin. She worked as a waitress. She was good at it, piling up tips because 16 years in her mother's bent world had taught her that one way to ensure survival was to be ingratiating. With her customers, she was indefatigably charming, relentlessly agreeable, and always eager to please. The relationship between a diner and a waitress was, to her way of thinking, the ideal relationship, because it was brief, formal, generally conducted with a high degree of politeness, and required no baring of the heart. "I am your guardian." In her obsessive determination to protect herself at all costs, she was always friendly with the other waitresses where she worked, but she never made friends with any of them. Friendships involved commitment, risks. She had learned not to make herself vulnerable to the hurt and betrayal that ensued from commitments.
Over the years, she'd had affairs with only two men. She had liked both, and had loved the second, but the first relationship had lasted 11 months, and the second only 13. Lovers, if they were worthwhile, required more than simple commitment. They needed revelation, sharing the bond of emotional intimacy. She found it difficult to reveal much about her childhood or her mother, in part because her utter helplessness during those years embarrassed her. More to the point, she had come to the hard realization that her mother had never really loved her, perhaps had never been capable of loving her or anyone. And how could she expect to be cherished by any man who knew that she'd been unloved even by her mother? She was aware that this attitude was irrational, but awareness didn't free her. She understood that she was not responsible for what her mother had done to her, but regardless of what so many therapists claimed in their books and on their radio talk shows, understanding alone didn't lead to healing. Even after a decade beyond her mother's control, China was at times convinced that all the dark events of all those troubled years could have been avoided if only she, China, had been a better girl, more worthy. "I am your guardian." She folded her hands on the table again. She leaned forward until her forehead was pressed to the backs of her thumbs, and she closed her eyes. The only close friend she'd ever had was Laura Templeton. Their relationship was something that she had wanted badly, but had never sought, desperately needed, but did little to nurture. It was purely a testament to Laura's vivaciousness, perseverance, and selflessness in the face of China's caution and reserve, a result of Laura's dear heart and her singular capacity to love. And now Laura was dead. "I am your guardian." In Laura's room, under the dead gaze of Freud, China had knelt beside the bed and whispered to her shackled friend, "I'll get you out of here." God, how it hurt to think of it. "I'll get you out of here." Her stomach knotted excruciatingly with self-disgust. "I'll find a weapon," she had promised. Laura, selfless to the end, had urged her to run, to get out. "Don't die for me," Laura had said. But China had answered, "I'll be back." Now here came grief again, swooping like a great dark bird into her heart, and she almost let its wings enfold her, too eager for the strange solace of those battering pinions, until she realized that she was using grief to knock humiliation from its perch. Grieving, she would have no room for self-loathing. "I am your guardian." Although the clerk had never fired the revolver, she should have checked it, she should have known, somehow, some way. Though she could not possibly have known what Vess had done with the bullets, she should have known. Laura had always told her that she was too hard on herself, that she would never heal if she kept inflicting new bruises on the old, in endless self-flagellation. But Laura was dead. "I am your guardian." China's humiliation festered into shame, and if humiliation was a good tool for repressing terror, shame was even better. Steeping in shame, she knew no fear at all, even though she was in shackles in the house of a sadistic murderer, with no one in the world looking for her. Justice seemed served by her being there. Then she heard footsteps approaching. She raised her head and opened her eyes. The killer entered from the laundry room, evidently returning from the girl in the cellar. Without speaking to China, without glancing at her, as if she didn't exist, he went to the refrigerator, removed a carton of eggs, and put it on the counter beside the sink. He deftly broke 8 eggs into a bowl and threw the shells in the trash. He set the bowl in the refrigerator and proceeded to peel and chop a Bermuda onion. China hadn't eaten in more than 12 hours. Nonetheless, she was dismayed to discover that she was suddenly ravenous. The onion was the sweetest scent that she had ever known, and her mouth began to water. After so much blood, after losing the only close friend she'd ever had, it seemed heartless to have an appetite so soon. The killer put the chopped onion into a Tupperware container, snapped the lid tight, and placed it in the refrigerator beside the bowl of eggs. Next, he grated half a wedge of cheddar cheese into another Tupperware container. He was brisk and efficient in the kitchen, and he seemed to be enjoying himself. He kept his work area neat. He also washed his hands thoroughly between each task, and dried them on a hand towel, not on the dish towel. Finally, the killer came to the dinette table. He sat across from China, relaxed and self-confident and college boy casual in his Dockers, braided belt, and soft chambray shirt. Shame, which had seemed on the verge of consuming her, instead had burned itself out for the time being. A strange combination of smoldering anger and bitter despondency had replaced it.
"Now," he said, "I'm sure you're hungry, and as soon as we have a little chat, I'll make cheese omelets with stacks of toast. But to earn your breakfast, you have to tell me who you are, where you were hiding at that service station, and why you're here."
She glared at him. With a smile, he said,
"Don't think you can hold out on me."
She would be damned rather than tell him anything.
"Here's how it is," he said. "I'll kill you anyway. I'm not sure how yet. Probably in front of Ariel. She's seen bodies before, but she's never been there at the moment itself, to hear that last scream and the sudden wetness of it all."
China tried to keep her eyes on him, show no weakness. He said,
"However I choose to do you, I'll make it a lot harder for you if you don't talk to me willingly. There are things I enjoy that can be done before or after you're dead. Cooperate, and I'll do them after."
China tried unsuccessfully to see some sign of madness in his eyes, such a merry shade of blue.
"Well, you're a sick son of a bitch."
Smiling again, he said,
"The last thing I expected you to be was tedious."
"I know why you sewed shut his eyes and mouth," she said.
"Ah, so you found him in the closet."
"You raped him before you killed him, or while you killed him. You sewed his eyes shut because he'd seen, sewed his mouth shut because you're ashamed of what you did, and you're afraid that, even dead, he might tell someone."
Unfazed, he said, "Actually, I didn't have sex with him."
"Liar."
"But if I had, I wouldn't have been embarrassed. You think I'm that unsophisticated? We're all bisexual, don't you think? I have the urge for a man sometimes, and with some of them I've indulged it. It's all sensation, just sensation."
"Maggot."
"I know what you're trying to do,"
he said amiably, clearly amused by her.
"But it just won't work. You're hoping one insult or another will set me off, as if I'm some hair-trigger psychopath who'll just explode if you call me the right name, push the right button, maybe insult my mother or say nasty things about the Lord. Then you hope I'll kill you fast in a wild rage and get it over with."
China realized that he was right, although she had not been consciously aware of her own intentions. Failure, shame, and the helplessness of being shackled had reduced her to a despair that she had preferred not to consider. Now she was sickened less by him than by herself, wondering if she was a quitter and a loser after all, just like her mother.
"But I'm not a psychopath," he said.
"Then what are you?"
"Oh, call me a homicidal adventurer, or perhaps the only clear-thinking person you've ever met. Maggot works better for me."
He leaned forward in his chair.
"Here's the thing. Either you tell me all about yourself, everything I want to know, or I'll work on your face with a knife while you sit there. For every question you refuse to answer, I'll take off a piece, the lobe of an ear, the tip of your pretty nose, carve you like Scrimshaw."
He said this not threateningly, but matter-of-factly, and she knew that he had the stomach for it.
"I'll take all day," he said, "and you'll be insane long before you're dead."
"All right."
"All right what? Conversation or Scrimshaw?"
"Conversation."
"Good girl."
She was prepared to die if it came to that, but she saw no point in suffering needlessly.
"What's your name?"
he asked. "Shepherd, China Shepherd. Chyna.
"Ah, not a cryptic chant after all."
"What?"
"Odd name."
"Is it?"
"Don't spar with me, China. Go on."
"All right, but first may I have something to drink? I'm dehydrated." At the sink he drew a glass of water. He put 3 ice cubes in it. He started to bring it to her, then halted and said,
I could add a slice of lemon.
She knew he wasn't joking. Home from the hunt, he was working now to recast himself from the role of savage stalker into that of accountant or clerk or real estate agent or car mechanic, or whatever it was that he did when he was passing for normal. Some sociopaths could put on a false persona that was more convincing than the best performances of the finest actors who had ever lived, and this man was probably one of those, although after immersion in wanton slaughter, he needed this period of adjustment to remind himself of the manners and courtesies of civilized society.
"No thanks," she said to the offer of lemon. "It's no trouble," he graciously assured her.
"Just the water." When he put the glass down, he slipped a cork-lined ceramic coaster under it. Then he sat across the table from her again. China was repelled by the prospect of drinking from a glass that he had handled, but she really was dehydrated. Her mouth was dry, and her throat was vaguely sore. Because of the cuffs, she picked up the glass in both hands. She knew that he was watching her for signs of fear. The water didn't slop around in the tumbler, the rim of the glass didn't chatter against her teeth. She truly wasn't afraid of him anymore, at least not for the moment, although maybe later, certainly later. Now her interior landscape was a desert under sullen skies, numbing desolation with the angry flicker of lightning toward a far horizon. She drank half of the water before she put the glass down.
"When I entered the room a moment ago," the killer said, "you were sitting with your hands folded, your head bowed against your hands. Were you praying?"
She thought about it. "No."
"There's no point lying to me."
"I'm not lying. I wasn't praying just then."
"But you do pray?"
"Sometimes."
"God fears me."
She waited. He said,
"God fears me. Those are words that can be made from the letters of my name."
"I see."
"Dragon seed."
"From the letters of your name," she said.
"Yes. And Forge of Rage."
"It's an interesting game."
"Names are interesting. Yours is Passive, a place name for a first name, and Shepherd, bucolic, fuzzily, Christian. When I think of your name, I see an Asian peasant on a hillside with sheep, or a slant-eyed Christ making converts among the heathens."
He smiled, amused by his banter.
"But clearly your name doesn't define you well. You're not a passive person."
"I have been," she said, "most of my life."
"Really? Well, you weren't passive last night."
"Not last night," she agreed. "But until then."
"My name, on the other hand, is a power name. Edgler Foreman Vess."
He spelled it for her.
"Not Edgar. Edgler. Like on the edge. And Vess. If you draw it out, it's like a serpent hissing."
"Demon."
"Yes, that's right. It's there in my name. Demon."
"Anger."
He seemed pleased by her willingness to play. "You're good at this, especially considering that you don't have pen and paper."
"Vessel," she said. "That's in your name, too."
"An easy one. But also semen. Vessel and semen. Female and male. Would you like to craft an insult out of that, China?"
Instead of replying, she picked up the glass and drank half of the remaining water. The ice cubes were cold against her teeth.
"Now that you've wet your whistle,"
Vess said,
"I want to know all about you. Remember, Scrimshaw."
China told him everything, beginning with the moment that she had heard a scream while sitting at the guest bedroom window in the Templeton house. She delivered her account in a monotone, not by calculation, but because suddenly she could speak no other way. She tried to vary her inflection, put life into her words, but failed. The sound of her voice droning through the events of the night scared her as Edgler Vess no longer did. Her account came to her as if she were listening to someone else speak, and it was the voice of a lost and defeated person. She told herself that she was not defeated, that she still had hope, that she would get the best of this murderous bastard one way or another— but her inner voice lacked all conviction. In spite of China's spiritless recitation of events, Vess was a rapt listener. He began in a relaxed slouch, lounging back in his chair. But by the time the china finished, he was leaning forward with his arms on the table, hunched toward her. He interrupted her several times to ask questions. At the end, he sat for a while in contemplative silence. She could not bear to look at him. She folded her hands on the table, closed her eyes, and put her forehead against the backs of her church door thumbs, as she had been when Vess had come out of the laundry room. She wasn't praying this time either. She lacked the hope needed for prayer. After a few minutes, she heard Vess's chair slide back from the table. He got up. She heard him moving around, and then the familiar clatter of any cook being busy in any kitchen. She smelled butter heating in a pan, then browning onions. In the telling of her story, China had lost her appetite, and it didn't return with the aroma of the onions. Finally, Vess said,
"Funny that I didn't smell you right away at the Templetons."
"You can do that?" she asked without raising her head from her hands. "You can just smell people out as if you were a damn dog?"
"Usually," he said, taking no offense,
and with what seemed to be utmost seriousness.
"And you must have made a sound more than once through the night. You surely can't be that stealthy. Even your breathing I should have heard."
Then came the sound of a wire whisk vigorously beating eggs in a bowl. She smelled bread toasting.
"In a still house, with everyone dead, your movement should have made currents in the air, like a cool breath on the back of my neck, shivering the fine hairs on my hands. Your every movement should have been a different texture against my eyes, and when I walked through a space where you'd just been, I should have sensed the displacement of air caused by your passage."
He was stone crazy. So cute in his chambray shirt, with his beautiful blue eyes, his thick dark hair combed straight back from his forehead, and the dimple in his left cheek, but pustulant and canker-ridden inside.
"My senses, you see, are unusually acute."
He ran the water in the sink. Without looking, she knew that he was rinsing the whisk. He wouldn't put it aside dirty. He said,
"My senses are so sharp because I've given myself to sensation. Sensation is my religion, you might say."
A sizzling arose, much louder than the cooking sound of onions, and a new aroma.
"But you are invisible to me," he said, "like a spirit. What makes you special?"
"Bitter," she murmured against the tabletop.
"If I was special, would I be here in chains?"
Although China hadn't actually spoken to him and wouldn't have thought that he could hear her above the crisp sputtering of eggs and onions, Vess said,
"I suppose you're right."
Later, when he put the plates on the table, she raised her head and moved her hands.
"Rather than make you eat with your hands, I'm going to give you a fork," he said, "because I assume you see the pointlessness of throwing it and trying to stick me in the eye."
She nodded.
"Good girl."
On her plate was a plump four-egg omelet oozing cheddar cheese and stippled with sautéed onions. On top were three slices of a firm tomato and a sprinkling of chopped parsley. Two pieces of butter toast, each neatly sliced on the diagonal, were arranged to bracket the omelet. He refilled her water glass and added two more cubes of ice. Famished only a short while ago, China now could hardly tolerate the sight of food. She knew that she must eat, so she picked at the eggs and nibbled the toast, but she would never be able to finish all that he had given her. Vess ate with gusto, but not noisily or sloppily. His table manners were beyond reproach, and he used his napkin frequently to blot his lips. China was deep in her private grayness, and the more that Vess appeared to enjoy his breakfast, the more her own omelet began to taste like ashes.
"You'd be quite attractive if you weren't so rumpled and sweaty, your face smudged with dirt, your hair straggly from the rain. Very attractive, I think. A real charmer under that grime. Maybe later I'll bathe you."
China Shepherd, untouched and alive. Uncannily, after a further silence, Edgler Vess said,
"Untouched and alive."
She knew that she had not spoken the prayer aloud.
"Untouched and alive," he repeated. "Is that what you said on the stairs earlier on your way down to Ariel?"
She stared at him speechless.
"Is it?"
Finally.
Yes. I've been wondering about it. You said your name and then those three words, though none of it made sense when I didn't know that China Shepherd was your name.
She looked away from him at the window. A Doberman roamed the backyard.
Was it a prayer?
He asked. In her desolation, China hadn't thought that he could scare her any more, but she had been wrong. His intuitiveness was frightening, and not entirely for reasons that she could understand. She looked away from the Doberman and met Vess's eyes. For one brief moment, she saw the dog within, a dark and merciless aspect.
Was it a prayer?
He asked again. Yes.
In your heart, China, deep in your heart, do you truly believe that God really exists? Be truthful now, not just with me, but with yourself.
At one time, not long ago, she had been just barely sure enough of what she believed to answer yes. Now she was silent.
Even if God exists, Vess said, does he know that you do?
She took another bite of the omelet. It seemed greasier than before, the eggs and butter and cheese too rich cloyed in her mouth, and she could hardly swallow. She put down her fork. She was finished. She'd eaten no more than a third of her meal. Vess finished the food on his plate, washing it down with coffee that he didn't offer her, no doubt because he thought that she would try to throw the hot brew in his eyes.
"You look so glum," Vess said.
She didn't reply.
"You're feeling like such a failure, aren't you? You failed poor Ariel, yourself, and God too, if he exists."
"What do you want with me?" she asked. She meant, why put me through this? Why not kill me and get it over with?
"I haven't figured that out yet," Vess said. "Whatever I do with you, it's got to be special. I feel you're special, whether you think you are or not, and whatever we do together should be intense."
She closed her eyes and wondered if she could find Narnia again after all these years. He said,
"I can't answer your questions as to what I want with you, but I have no doubt about what I want with Ariel. Would you like to hear what I intend to do with her?"
Most likely she was too old to believe in anything, even just a magic wardrobe. Vess's voice came out of her internal grayness, as if he lived there as well as in the real world.
"I asked you a question, China. Remember our bargain? You can either answer it or I'll slice off a piece of your face. Would you like to hear what I intend to do with Ariel?"
"I'm sure I know."
"Yes, some of it. Sex, that's obvious. She's a luscious piece. I haven't touched her yet, but I will. And I believe she's a virgin. At least in the days when she still talked, she said she was. And she didn't seem like the kind of girl who would lie."
Or there was the wild wood beyond the river, Ratty and Mole and Mr. Badger, green boughs hanging full in the summer sun, and Pan piping in the cool shadows under the trees.
"And I want to hear her crying, lost and crying. I want to smell the purity of her tears. I want to feel the exquisite texture of her screams, know the clean smell of them, and the taste of her terror. There's always that, always that."